in the limelight.
The collective wealth of 651 richest billionaires in the U.S. has increased by over $1 trillion since March 18th, roughly when the states began issuing shutdown orders, according to a new analysis of Forbes financial data by Americans for Tax Fairness and the Institute for Policy Studies. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Mike Ludwig Ryder. This article is published under the heading, New Report Shows America's Top Billionaires' Wealth Skyrocketing During Pandemic. Here's the details of this article. The net wealth enjoyed by the richest billionaires in the United States has ballooned since the beginning of the pandemic, according to a new report. Meanwhile, millions of households are struggling to put food on the table and pay rent as COVID-19 deaths and infections surge nationwide, underscoring the nation's vast inequality. The collective wealth of 651 richest billionaires has increased by over $1 trillion since March 18th, roughly when states began issuing shutdown orders, according to a new analysis of Forbes financial data by Americans for Tax Fairness and the Institute for Policy Studies. The combined net worth of the richest people in the U.S. totaled $4 trillion this week, more than four times the $908 billion price tag of an economic relief package that has taken center stage in the Senate as U.S. Congress struggles to strike a bipartisan deal before the end of the year. A stock market surge combined with more people staying at home has been a boon for tech companies and their CEOs. Familiar names in tech top the report's list of the richest people getting richer: Jeff Bezos of Amazon, Bill Gates of Microsoft, Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, and Elon Musk of Tesla. The four men have seen stock prices for their companies soar since the pandemic began, making them centibillionaires worth over $100 billion each. Then there is Dan Gilbert, chairman of Quicken Loans, a company specializing in short and long-term personal loans and home mortgages. As people struggle to pay their bills, Gilbert's wealth has grown 543% from $6.1 billion to $41.8 billion, the second highest increase among billionaires, after the net increase enjoyed by Ernest Garcia II, who makes his fortune selling used cars. The economy looks much different to the rest of Americans. Millions of Americans have lost jobs during the pandemic, and food and housing insecurity have skyrocketed to crisis levels. Across the U.S., images of cars lined up for miles to receive food donations have illustrated the severity of the crisis. More than 1 in 10 adults sometimes or often do not have enough money for food, according to estimates based on federal census data. Last month, more than half the U.S. worried about affording food as the holidays approached. About 34% of the U.S., roughly 83 million adults, report difficulty paying for basic expenses such as food, medical bills, and mortgage payments. An estimated 40% of children in the U.S. live in homes that are either behind on rent or facing food hardship. And rates of food insecurity are even higher among families of color. At least 12 million people are now behind on rent, and housing activists are fighting evictions across the U.S. despite a federal moratorium on eviction set to expire at the end of the month. as tens of millions of Americans suffer from the health and economic ravages of this pandemic, a few hundred billionaires add to their massive fortunes, said Frank Clement, executive director of Americans for Tax Fairness, in a statement recently. Their pandemic profits are so immense that America's billionaires could pay for a major COVID relief bill and still not lose a dime of their pre-virus riches, he added. Meanwhile, layoffs appear to be on the rise alongside the surge in new COVID-19 cases, which topped 118,667 nationally recently. Another 1.3 million people filed new unemployment claims last week, bringing initial claims to their highest point since September, according to Economic Policy Institute. People who have relied on unemployment insurance since the pandemic began are seeing their incomes dwindle as the benefits run dry. If U.S. Congress fails to pass a relief package before year-end deadlines, 12 million people across the U.S. will lose their unemployment benefits after Christmas. As of November 14, 20 million people were collecting unemployment nationally, according to the Labor Department. Nearly 98,000 businesses have closed permanently. Recently, the Washington Post reported that negotiations over another relief package in Congress are on the verge of collapse. Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi warned talks could extend beyond Christmas, when multiple programs provided by the stimulus package passed in March are set to expire. A $908 billion bipartisan proposal at the center of the negotiations would not provide a second round of stimulus checks to all taxpayers. The proposal would extend emergency unemployment benefits until March with a $300 weekly bonus, potentially helping millions of households from falling off a fiscal cliff. However, there is currently not enough Republican support in the Senate to pass the stopgap relief package, according to reports. The relief package would also provide $160 billion in relief for state and local governments, along with $25 billion in housing assistance for renters. Although housing advocates say at least $100 billion is needed, Democrats hope a final deal will include an extended moratorium on evictions. Without relief, an estimated 30 to 40 million people could lose their homes, according to the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Clement said the $1 trillion in new wealth enjoyed by 651 top billionaires could provide relief to the entire country. Indeed, $1 trillion is double the two-year budget gap faced by all state and local governments, according to the report. Their wealth growth is so great that they alone could provide a $3,000 stimulus payment to every man, woman, and child in the U.S. and still be richer than they were 10 months ago, Clement said. The report on wealth gains among billionaires received favorable review from the fact-checkers at PolitiFact.
On Saturday, supporters of U.S. President Donald Trump protesting the outcome of the last month's presidential election clashed with counter-protesters in the U.S. Capitol, Washington, D.C. Police used pepper spray to break up the brawls that erupted between Trump's fervent supporters, Proud Boys, and Antifa counter-protesters. Four people who had sustained potentially life-threatening stab wounds were taken to hospital. Police also said 23 people were arrested.
There's a famous saying that during times of crises like this is when fascism starts to rise. And that's what we're seeing in the United States. We're seeing the rise of a far right, a very Islamophobic far right as well, that is anti-immigrant, that has hatred for people from the global south, that want to reclaim the United States as a white settler colonial state versus everyone else. Because Trump is no longer part of the equation, this right-wing radical base is becoming more violent, more of a threat, and people really need to be careful, because during times like this of crisis, we saw it happen in Germany, and you know, we're seeing something very similar in the United States.
The far-right supporters also rallied outside the U.S. Supreme Court, where retired Army General Mike Flynn delivered a speech. Flynn, who served as Trump's national security advisor for a brief period, was recently pardoned by the president after pleading guilty to lying to federal investigators during a probe into Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. Donald Trump cheered on the protesters. In a post on his Twitter account, the president celebrated the demonstration, which was a follow-up to the last month's much-publicized Stop the Steal rally. Those rallies also ended in violence, with pro-Trump and counter-protesters engaging in fights that left multiple people injured, including four police officers. The Proud Boys is a self-proclaimed Western chauvinist group whose ideology has been labeled as misogynistic, Islamophobic, and anti-immigration. Trump made controversy during presidential debates when he refused to condemn white supremacists, urging the far-right group to stand back and stand down.
I'm willing to do anything. I want to see
peace.
Well,
then do it, sir.
Say it. You want to call them? What do you want to call them? Give me a name.
White supremacists and right
like me to condemn?
White supremacists and right
Proud Boys, stand back and stand by.
The group has claimed its members, usually carrying weapons and military gear, only use violence in self-defense. But some of the group members have been convicted of committing violent crimes against counter-protesters. Donald Trump is continuing his attempts to maintain power, even though federal authorities greenlit U.S. President-elect Biden's transition late last month. His refusal to concede has fueled angry demonstrations by his most loyal supporters, drawing fierce opposition against the Democrats. This is expected to complicate matters for President-elect Joe Biden, who vowed to, quote, heal the divided U.S.
I think the fact that there's so much chaos going on in the United States right now, I think that Trump doesn't really care about the lives of innocent people. He doesn't care about the lives of the average working class person in the United States. What he cares about is fulfilling the interest of his lobby that helped him get elected into office. We're talking about the prison industrial complex, the military industrial complex, Israel, a lot of Zionists who are pushing all they can to escalate war against Iran right now.
Donald Trump took up office with his signature motto of making America great again. 4 years on, the United States seems far from what Trump claimed to achieve.
On Thursday, Morocco joined the list of Arab nations that normalized relations with Israel. The U.S. President Donald Trump announced the news on his Twitter page. He said the two sides decided to start full diplomatic relations. Morocco was among those countries that never had official ties with Israel since its occupation of Palestine in 1948. But in unofficial levels, the two sides have always shared relations and intelligence. In 1993, after Israel and the Palestinian Liberation Organization signed the Oslo Accord, Rabat and Tel Aviv began a series of low-level ties. But Morocco suspended the relations after the outbreak of the Second Palestinian Intifada in the year 2000. That is why Rabat now called the normalization deal a resumption of diplomatic relations. Several reports by Moroccan media indicate that King Mohammed VI has sought to restore ties with Israel in recent years. But the government has denied or remained silent about such news.
The normalization between Israel and all the Arab and Muslim countries is really nothing new, at the exception of that this normalization is coming out to light. All these countries have never declared war on Israel and enjoyed excellent ties with the Israelis. Therefore, the only difference today is just this relationship is overt. So we're learning about it, about the exchange of diplomatic and normalization between Israel and these countries. It's just a mere propaganda and an advertisement for Netanyahu to boost his image domestically because of his domestic troubles at home.
Morocco agreed to this rapprochement in return for American recognition of the kingdom's claim over the long-disputed territory of the Western Sahara region. In February, Israeli media reported that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had lobbied the U.S. to recognize Moroccan sovereignty over the Western Sahara in exchange for the deal. Such a move gave Morocco what it has for long wanted, but it also undercuts an independent movement in the Western Sahara region, which has rejected Morocco's claims of sovereignty. The Polisario Front, an independent movement from Western Sahara, slammed the U.S. move and said it highly regrets Trump's decision. But the people of Western Sahara are not the only ones who are angry at the U.S. and Morocco. Palestinians have denounced the agreement also. The Palestine Liberation Organization said Morocco's decision was unacceptable. The resistance movement Hamas said that Israel uses every new normalization deal to increase its aggression against Palestinians. Morocco's royal court said that King Mohammed VI had called Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and reiterated his commitment to the rights of Palestinians to have their own state. But it seems that Palestine has a hard time to believe the king. Behind the news that Israel and Morocco will establish the first formal diplomatic relationship, there lies almost six decades of close, secret cooperation on intelligence and military matters. Israel has helped Morocco obtain weapons and intelligence gathering gear and learn how to use them. Tel Aviv also held Rabat to assassinate an opposition leader. In return, Morocco has helped Israel in matters like spying on other Arab countries. The two sides have had no problems contacting each other. The only thing they needed was a broker. The U.S. made that deal happen, and in the meantime, struck a deal for itself. Following the announcement, the administration of Trump has moved forward with a major arms sale to Morocco. The package is worth $1 billion and includes drones and precision-guided weapons. The White House has reportedly sent a notice to Congress about the potential deal.
We saw with the United Arab Emirates that the Americans promised to sell the F-35 and still didn't manage to get this deal off because the Israelis are blocking it and imposing specific conditions to keep the superiority over any other country. Therefore, with Morocco wants some armed drone. Actually, it could have bought these armed drones from Turkey, and Turkey is supplying European countries and the international market with its most advanced drone, particularly after the last battle that its drone went through in Azerbaijan-Armenian conflict. I don't think it is the sale of arms that is attracting Morocco. I think it's a pressure from Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who wants to gather as many countries, Islamic and Arab countries as possible before he moves in, and for Saudi Arabia to announce its official normalization with Israel.
This would be among the first drone sales under the Trump administration. Morocco is the latest country to agree to normalize relations with Israel and strike a deal with the U.S. as well. First, it was the UAE. The country announced its decision to establish diplomatic ties with Israel in August. In return, Washington provided Abu Dhabi with F-35 fighter jets. Bahrain and Sudan followed suit, with Sudan being removed from the U.S. blacklist of terrorism sponsor countries. White House senior advisor Jared Kushner said a similar deal between Israel and Saudi Arabia could happen soon. For now, it's unclear what the U.S. will give to Riyadh in return for striking a deal with Tel Aviv.
There's a certain set of rules when it comes to the act of war, setting out what can and cannot be done during an armed conflict. And should that law be breached, then the International Criminal Court, or ICC, is tasked with investigating and bringing guilty parties to justice. Yet it seems the court is losing its credibility, as the ICC has recently announced that it intends to abandon its inquiry into British war crimes during the Iraq War, leaving the victims of British atrocities in the country equally abandoned as they seek justice against the British military. However, in spite of the case being dropped, the prosecutor behind the investigation, Fatou Bensouda, has been left in no doubt that the British military committed no end of crimes while stationed in Iraq, leaving many questioning why the ICC would suddenly drop the case.
But obviously because Britain is one of the permanent five members of the Security Council. And on political grounds, Britain has actually been fairly supportive of the International Criminal Court, even when its close ally and boss, in fact, the US, has fought against it. The British have stood by it, and they've been fairly consistent on it.
So what then are the allegations against the British? Crimes that have said to have been committed include willful killing of innocent civilians, torture of prisoners of war, inhumane and cruel treatment, and rape, all of which are highly illegal under the international rules of conflict and hence constitute as war crimes. The decision by the ICC to drop the case is being blamed on the lack of evidence submitted by the British military, raising the question from Human Rights Watch as to why the UK government has repeatedly shown little interest in investigating the crimes committed by its army. However, the British are no strangers to turning a blind eye to their crimes, as demonstrated through their brutal occupation of states during their imperial days, with the British also having been involved in conflicts in Afghanistan, the north of Ireland, and elsewhere. It remains to be seen as to whether the war crimes seen in Iraq have not been emulated elsewhere, and much like these, left to be forgotten in the past, just like the victims who were subjected to the British crimes. With more and more allegations coming to light of crimes being committed during conflict, from the abuse of Iraqi prisoners by the US and British, to the recent allegations that Australian Special Forces were involved in the killing of innocent civilians in order to pass initiation tests, it just goes to show how deep the problem really lies. Currently, the World War Crimes Court is also heavily involved in the investigation of US crimes committed during conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan. Yet could the investigation into such crimes be suddenly dropped by the ICC should the US military refuse to cooperate? There does, however, lie a problem in the authority of the ICC. Namely, that the US has stated that it just does not recognise the court, with the US President Donald Trump stating that the ICC has no jurisdiction over them, something that's been echoed by the Israeli regime, who, much like the US, UK and Australia, are guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Yet with the UK failing to assist the ICC in its investigation, nor having even brought one single prosecution against any of its personnel, how then can the ICC execute justice with no parties interested in cooperating with them or even acknowledging its authority?
Well, it isn't really. By the way, I think that the British have actually prosecuted the military for various crimes over the years. Not enough of them. I mean, they've committed many of them over the centuries, whether it was in India or Kenya or, even more recently. But they have prosecuted some in Northern Ireland. They were prosecuting people, but in this case, they've investigated and they've. But I'm not trying to make excuses for them, but from their point of view, they could say that they didn't have enough evidence to meet the burden of a prosecution.
Should the ICC continue to be ignored or see its authority blanked, the question that remains to be asked is whether the body has lost all credibility, and if so, how can the rest of the international community allow the US and its allies to undermine such international bodies as and when it suits them?
Lord. large gaps, a looming deadline, and still no appetite for any compromise. The European Union and Britain are digging their heels in, sending jitters throughout Europe. Britain and the European Union face another fast-approaching deadline to conclude marathon talks on their future relationship. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson arrived in Brussels on Wednesday and sat down for tense talks with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen 3 weeks before the Brexit transition period ends. The two failed to break the logjams in the talks. The only thing the two sides agreed on was perhaps to continue the talks at least through Sunday. The negotiations are tough and stressful because so much is at stake. UK and EU positions remain far apart over access to fishing waters, rules about stabilizing businesses, and how any new deal would be enforced and policed.
Britain controls a tremendous amount of sovereign territory in the sea, and that was basically ceded to Brussels to decide what's done with that back in 1973. So that, I think, is going to be the big sticking point. You know, the traditionally large area of sea around Britain, including out into the Atlantic, which Britain has controlled, has been extremely bountiful, for particularly for the French fishermen who've been fishing those seas. And so I think possibly the fishing rights are going to be the biggest sticking point.
The UK Premier admitted after his talks in Brussels that there was, quote, a strong possibility that Britain and the EU would fail to hammer out a free trade agreement at the end of the year. The disappointing outcome of the talks in Brussels triggered the EU to publish contingency plans for the split in trading ties. Observers believe the publication of the EU contingency plans at this point shows that the Europeans are seriously preparing for a possible no-deal Brexit. The European bloc says it intends to avoid immediate chaos at the beginning of January.
The publication of contingency plans by Brussels is actually quite useful, but you know, this is the sort of thing that should have been published, I think, years ago. So it was laid out clearly for the public and for businesses, the sort of thing that may happen if there was no deal.
Long-running negotiations on a trade deal with Britain seem to be reaching a make-or-break moment. But the EU member states insist that despite the looming deadline, they will not be forced into a bad deal. Some European leaders have been loud in rejecting any unsatisfactory agreement. French President Emmanuel Macron has been particularly outspoken. He has insisted that UK firms can expect preferential access to Europe's single market only if they obey its rules. France is worried that the British side is pushing for a deal that could give UK companies an unfair competitive advantage in the European market. The French government has warned that France could veto a bad deal, accusing London of seeking to divide the EU to get better terms. France's demands and concerns are widely shared by other EU member states. European diplomats say all countries in the European Union are serious about defending their collective interests.
The European Union and Brussels do not want to give Britain a deal which any other state in the EU will look at and think that's something we could do with and we would like. So on that level, they want to give Britain a bad deal.
Meanwhile, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has shown little sign of flexibility. Is he bluffing, or does he really believe the UK can easily weather the storm even if it leaves the bloc without a deal? An economically damaging divorce would undoubtedly hurt both sides. But observers warn that the UK would be impacted much more severely than the EU in case of a no-deal departure.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
inside Israel.
It's getting ever so hard to marry in Israel. Many Israelis are not allowed to marry in Israel. Simply put, there is no civil marriage in Israel. Others simply opt to not have a religious marriage, marry outside of Israel. But now with the coronavirus pandemic, they cannot do that either.
All right, so now we're talking a lot about Jewish law as well and how that pertains to marriage. How do marriage and divorce laws work in Israel? Because it isn't only Jewish law here.
That's a great question. In most Western countries, the authority to judge matters relating divorce is in the hands of the family court. But here in Israel, marriage and divorce are under the jurisdiction of both the rabbinical court and the family court. So the legal systems of both of these courts are authorized to take care of these matters regarding divorce. So unfortunately, where they overlap gets really murky.
In Israel, marriage can only be approved by religious rabbinate courts. Also, marriage must be based on the Jewish religion. However, not all Israelis, according to the chief rabbinate, are Jewish, including immigrants and converts, among others. This has been the case since 1947. The generations then understood. But now, the younger generations, and with the influx of Soviet immigrants, things are changing, and not necessarily for the better. Israelis who cannot marry are having a hard time leaving Israel to do so. In Israel, there are no marriage registrations for Israelis who opt for a non-religious ceremony or those turned away by the rabbinate. Usually, thousands of Israelis in Israel who cannot marry under religious Israeli law do so outside of Israel. But this year, the coronavirus pandemic has prevented many from doing so. In Israel, there is no such a thing as civil marriage or divorce. Israel allows marriages to be held only under religious law, banning those who cannot or will not comply with a rabbi's demands from marrying. This is because marriage and divorce, among others, are under the jurisdiction of the courts of the chief rabbinate in Israel. Ultimately, this entity gets to decide what or who is Jewish and what or who is not. Under the chief rabbinate's orders, converts, non-Jews, and immigrants cannot marry in Israel. Under Israeli law, marriage and divorce resides with religious authorities, but a growing number of couples have opted not to involve the rabbinate in their personal lives. The rabbinate is run by Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox Jews who abide by legislation held over from the days of Ottoman rule over pre-1948 Palestine. In 1947, David Ben-Gurion, later the first prime minister of Israel, and the religious parties, which many of them were there before the influx of the white Jewish European settlers, reached an agreement that included an understanding that matters of personal status in Israel, which included marriage, would continue to be determined by religious authorities. This arrangement has been termed the status quo agreement and has been maintained despite numerous changes of cabinets ever since.
Well, you see, Israel is not completely, Israel is not a theocracy, although religion has a very powerful role. It was envisioned in the early days of the state in 1948. It was envisioned as a liberal society, but because it is a Jewish state, because the religious minority in Israel was not ready to define it completely as a secular institution, so the rabbinate has a very important role in Israel. It is part of the government. So it's not a private affair of people. The rabbinate in Israel, like in many other countries in which religion plays a prominent role, Israeli rabbis are actually government officials. They get a salary from the government. They are like a bureaucrat of the state. So marriage, because it is a very important civic institution, it is run by religious people. That's the situation in Israel. You can marry without a rabbi, but your marriage is not exactly the same thing in terms of your relations with the government. So that's the situation.
Well,
Well, what people used to do, those people who did not want to marry with a rabbi and did not want to have a religious marriage, the only option was to go and marry in civic religion outside of Israel. Usually people would go to Cyprus. And then somebody like a municipal official will marry them, because there are two mature people. They come and say, we want to marry, and then there is a civic agreement, and they can marry, and they can come back to Israel, and their marriage would be recognized as civic marriage. But now nobody can do that, or very few can do that, because nobody goes to Cyprus now. There is another option in Israel that people can marry, because you see, the Jewish marriage are defined in such a way that if you have your spouse you want to marry, the only thing you have to do is you have to stand with in the company of others who are witnesses and say that you are ready to marry this woman, and she is ready to marry you, and you basically have done the social ritual of marriage. You don't need a rabbi. But in Israel, in order to get all the benefits from the state as a married couple, you have to be registered in the rabbinate. But basically, you can marry your loved one, the person you love, without any problems. There are many people who marry without the official, that a rabbi officiate the marriage. You can do that. These are not they are almost civic marriage, but they are not in the same status. So there is some vague boundaries between the different arrangements for marriage in Israel.
The rabbinate inside Israel is very powerful, very, very powerful. They don't let to bring other laws into the state of Israel, because from the beginning of the state of Israel, they made a deal with the Zionist states, with Ben Gurion, to have the power of marry the couples. And so they had an agreement when they founded this Zionist state. Even the Zionist state was not a religious state. They are mixing religion with Zionism. At the beginning, the Jewish religion, the religious Jews were against the Zionist state. The Zionist state was founded by non-religious Jews. So then it came a mixture between religious Jews that wanted to found these Zionist states, and they created a symbiosis between religion, Jewish religion, and Zionism and Zionist political ideas. But that's not the original Jewish religion, and it was not also the Zionist project. It is a mixture of both. Well, it could if they have a government that doesn't include rabbis or rabbinical parties, I mean religious parties, like the Shas. If they have an election and they make a deal with all the parties that are not religious, it could they could make something to change the law.
Yes, we have that problem. This is it was in the beginning a small problem. It was a problem that some people can say this is not really happened, but today we know this is a big problem. I am a friend in a group in Israel of lawyers and professor in law, and this is what we do. We speak about that and we do some action to stop that. I don't think we can stop that now because it's so big, but maybe we can a little bit put the light on action that happened and put the woman outside over and over again all the time. I think now in Israel we stay in very bad situation. I think we go backward, and I think that a lot of people want to say this is like religion people that make that problem, but this is not only religion people, and it's not all of the religion people. This is a group of people that they have interests, and this is what they want to do.
Currently, thousands of couples are not able to get married at all, since going abroad is not an option due to the coronavirus pandemic, and the chief rabbinate will not perform a ceremony and provide legal recognition. The rabbinate standards and interpretations in these matters are generally used by the Israeli Interior Ministry in registering marriages and divorces. This legislation is amenable to the rabbinic establishment only. Many Israelis find they are turned away by the rabbinical authorities on the basis of Jewish law. Among them come from families who have immigrated to Israel from former Soviet republics and cannot provide the rabbinate with a required proof of their Judaism. Throughout the decades, there have been attempts to change the law, one such way as allowing civil marriages to be held by foreign governments under embassy ground. This had been thwarted by religious political parties that have historically held the deciding vote in coalition cabinets in Israel. Long before the coronavirus pandemic, hundreds of thousands of Israelis found themselves searching for options that included travel abroad or entering contractual cohabitation agreements just to validate their love and desire for family. For many Israelis, it has been and remains unacceptable that a person who is a citizen of Israel, a productive and law-abiding member of society, still does not have the most basic right to marry in Israel. This is why many are now calling for full civil marriage in Israel, which does not require any contact with the rabbinate for those who do not want it.
Well, the official government personnel will not help them very much, because in Israel, in order, for example, a young couple get married, if they want to go and get, let's say, mortgage to buy their first home from the government, some kinds of assistance, they would not be able to do that because they are not recognized as a married couple. Okay? But for any practical purposes, they can be married. And there is a special status for people like that. For example, a man and a woman can live together, and they are, for all practical purposes, are married if they live together and they share their life. They don't need the official stamp. But if you need some official assistance from the government, for example, in questions of will and a question of inheritance and a question of buying a house and all that, so the government intervenes and it says, no, if you want our support, the government support, you need to be married according to our rule. And our rule are religious rules. That's the situation in Israel. So to some extent, it is a very troubling situation. Many people don't like it. many people don't want the rabbi intervene in their life, because, for example, if you want to divorce later on, you have to do it with some agreement of the rabbinate. Well, the rabbinate is a very powerful institution, but you see, it is not, its power is not unlimited. It is quite limited, but they are very powerful. Why? Because they command and they control civic relations that people are so important for people, the question of marriage. Because Israel is defined as a Jewish state, Judaism has a very profound role in the political arrangement of the country. So the political parties, who are religious parties, throughout the years were national system, but also in the religious sphere. So they are very powerful, but not unlimited force. The civil authorities also can limit their power. Yes, they can, but not. It is not. Depends on what issue. For example, we have in Israel the issue of religious young people who study in religious institution do not serve in the army, and many people resent that because they think that if you are a citizen, like everybody else, you have to pay taxes, you have to work, and you have to serve in the army like everybody else. In Israel, quite a sizable minority of people who do not work and they study, and what they call that their studies is their work, because they study religious things. And the political parties, who are religious parties, defend this, their right not to serve in the army and not even to work, and that's especially a privilege for males, not so much for females. So there are many twists and many interesting things that have developed in Israel that were not that like that in Jewish communities before the state of Israel.
On social media, Israelis talk about fundamental issues. Ron Miretti says, as a Jew, this rabbinate bothers me. No one should be able to tell me I'm not Jewish enough. You want to continue to lose internal support? That's how you do it. Angry Dad says, Israel is now largely statutory, and there are specific laws putting family law matters, including matrimonial and divorce, in the jurisdiction of the rabbinate.
They have to go to another country, but I heard that it's a new news that the Norwegian from Norway government made a solution that they could marry by civil law in their embassy in Israel, so they don't have to travel to other countries to do that. That could be to Arab immigrants, not religious people, LGBT community, etc., etc. You know, this law in Israel, it's a mixture of secular law inherited by the British rule. The British inherited all the law except the marriages, the civil law for the marriages and the family law. So it is a mixture. It is not a theocratical law. It is not a democratically law. It is some mixture. So it has to be a solution to to help all these people who want to marry and make some changes in this kind of mixture law between religious and secular judges.
Norway has offered to allow Israelis to get civil marriages at their embassy and consulate, as coronavirus restrictions have prevented them from traveling to Cyprus. Cyprus is a common destination for civil marriages. The issue is being debated, but it's not new. The concept of allowing Israelis to marry on foreign embassy grounds has been proposed before, but religious political parties did not allow it then. And now many believe that they will not allow it to happen, even in these distressful, uncertain times. This is why many in Israel despise the rabbinate. More and more Israelis are calling for its disbandment. Of course, that would be highly unlikely, as it is too powerful and it's essentially part of the Israeli regime. For now, Israelis just can't have a civil marriage. Here's the news making the press in Israel. Ynet News, a report by the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants NGO, describes subhuman conditions and treatment akin to torture, such as being hit with belts, lack of contact with the outside world, and just moments of free time in the open air. The report by the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants for 2019 gathered dozens of testimonies, which also revealed shocking incidents at several migrant detention facilities where those suspected of visa violations, illegal entry, or unauthorized arrival are detained while the authorities work to find out if they are residing in Israel legally. The Times of Israel weekly protests against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu continue amid wintry weather as demonstrators gathered in plazas, intersections, and overpasses throughout and across Israel for the rallies, now on their 22nd week. Police detained four people during the rally, and a woman in her 60s was taken for medical treatment after allegedly being shoved to the ground by a cop. The Jerusalem Post, Israel police is expected to submit indictments against leaders of the protests against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the coming days. The indictments are expected to be for offenses such as obstructing an on-duty officer and violence against police officers. Senior police officers have said that a lot of pressure has been applied to the state attorney to approve the indictments, according to Haaretz. Police must have state attorney authorization for indictments, including those that they are able to issue independently. This is designed to prevent the police from being able to limit freedom of speech. Globes. Governor of the Bank of Israel, Amir Yaron, presented a forecast of a debt GDP ratio of 87% in 2023 without spending cuts. Israel will have to make substantial budget cuts starting from 2022 in order to avoid a downgrade of its credit rating. Governor of the Bank of Israel, Amir Yaron.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech.
The best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned. The term Ul al-Albab in Ayah 190 of Surah Al-Imran means those who possess intellects. Now, the concept of possessing intellect does not mean simple understanding of the signs of Allah. This means that intellect possessors contemplate on the creation of Allah. Now, there are some people who have knowledge about the solar system and understand the order that exists on the Earth and other planets. However, they do not contemplate on that and have a scientific look at it merely without connecting it to a higher almighty power. Such people are not considered intellect possessors according to the Quran. Ul al-Albab are those who can connect all these orderly manners to Allah. In other words, the real lob or wisdom is for those who think about the higher power who created this. If people leave their biases, disagreements, ignorance, and enmities, then they will be able to find out the true source behind all the creations on the galaxy. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
IRIB English Radio.